This is a continuation of a step study we're doing, and I've been privileged to ask to do this. And my name is Russell Spatz, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Russell.
I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since January 25th, 1981, and I'm grateful for that, and I'm going to share a little bit about my experience. I'm going to try to sort of touch upon and talk about the fifth step. That's about where we're at here. But I've noticed that the longer I'm sober, and if I don't drink, I guess in January I'll have 31 years, and which isn't a record around here. It's a record for me, but my sponsor's got 57. I've had some really wonderful sponsors. Man, I want to share some experiences I've had, some thoughts I've had. I have a few opinions. I'll share those. You don't have to agree with anything. Don't worry about it. You don't have to do it. You know, I'm not forcing this upon you. I'm just, I can't impose my theology, my religion, my feelings about this thing on anybody, but my job is to expose what my beliefs are and what has happened to me. And I think experience is important. Anybody who's ever been around alcoholics, I used to be a bar drinker. You know, when you're a bar drinker, being a bar drinker is an amazing thing. You sit around with a bunch of people and you talk, and they're all talking at the same time. And I'm wondering whether anybody's listening to anything. I don't even know that. But we're all expressing strongly held opinions. And you have a lot of opinions. When I was an alcoholic, I'm sort of like the way they are in the big book. You know, read this big book. And at the end, after you read all this thing, what do they say? They say, we know but a little. Well, thanks for telling us now, you know? I mean, we thought you guys were the, you know, knew everything. But they say, no, we all know. You know, that I'm sort of like them, you know, when I first came into alcoholics, but right before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I knew everything. And all I did was screw up my life. I thought I knew everything. And all I did was make a mess out of my life. And now my life is unbelievably incredible, and I know absolutely nothing. So maybe ignorance is bliss. I don't know what the story is. And I'm here to share the nothing I know with you. So that's the way we do it in here. So so if you can hang around long enough, we'll all get stupid together and be happy. Or as my sponsor used to say, Russ, would you rather be right or be happy? And I said, well, I want both, of course. And he says, you can't have both. You know, you can either have right, or you can, if you have right, if you want to be right, then you're going to be in fights with a lot of people. You're going to be constantly defending your position. You're always going to have the last word. But you got to make a decision. It's one or the other, and it's not both. But it's like so many other things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how they say when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears? We hear the answers. The answers are right in front of us, but we're not necessarily ready to hear the answers. You know, if you're not ready to hear the answers, you won't hear it. You'll make it go away. You'll angry it away. You're going to angry something away. That's what you'll do. And you just won't hear it. And then one day after your 15th relapse, and by the time you're 50 years old, and, you know, maybe you've got liver cancer or something like that, all of a sudden somebody will say something in a meeting that you've been hearing for 50 years, and all of a sudden it'll make absolute sense to you. And you'll say, now I get it. And you'll say, you know, why didn't I get that deal before? Because you weren't ready to receive it. You know, one of the great lines in the Bible is Jesus says, let all who have ears hear. Because a lot of people didn't hear. You know, a lot of people in AA don't hear. You know, you've had experiences, if you've been in here, either with yourself or with other people, of either having people going up to you before you came in here, or you going up to people who are ruining their lives with alcohol, and you've said to them, you're killing yourself. You've showed them all the evidence. You've showed them everything. It's absolutely clear. You can prove it mathematically that they're hurting people. Their lives are going down the drain, and they look at you like it's like talking to a wall, and they say, mind your own business. There's nothing wrong with my life. And you shake your head because you don't understand. It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating. And then after a few stints in jail, or you lose your job or something like happens, you come in here and all of a sudden it's so clear to you. You're giving testimony about your prowess over alcohol. It's so clear to you. You know, 2 weeks ago, you know, you thought you could never live without alcohol. It was impossible to live without alcohol. It was so clear that you had to have alcohol. And if anybody came up to you and even spoke anything bad about alcohol, you know, you wanted to slice and dice them and say, mind your own business. And now it's like the centerpiece of your life. It's so clear. You know, how could people not understand? How can your sister and your brother continue to do it? You know, and here's the deal. That's sort of obvious to you. What's not obvious to you is the 5,000 other old ideas that are going on in your mind right now that if I talk to you about them, you know what you'd say to me? You'd say, mind your own business. And they're holding you back. You know, because the real alcoholism centers in our minds, not our body, because what we find out after we come in here, of course, you know, alcohol takes over our lives so much we start thinking that alcohol consumption is the problem. And, of course, when we come in here, it is the problem. It's the thing that's ruining everything. But you ultimately come in here and you get rid of the alcohol and you find out, like it says, men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's why you drink. They're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You drank because you hate not drinking. I mean, that's why alcoholics drink. They can't stand not drinking. They can't stand being so. I mean, I drank because I, you know, you probably needed a reason to drink. Not me. I drank because I was awake. Awake was good enough for me. You know what I mean? I was awake and I was drinking, you know, and I didn't even experience alcohol. You don't even experience alcoholism until you've been sober a few months or years, you know. You experience, well, you know, before you come in here, you experience something called drunk. You don't even give alcoholism a running start, you know what I mean? It could be 5 miles down in the horizon, it raises its ugly head, and before it even gets here, you say, I need a drink. And you drink it away. That's what you use it for. You use alcohol to cure alcoholism. We named the disease after the cure. I drank alcohol because no woman, no amount of clothes, no amount of money, no job, you know, no losing weight, no nothing ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. So I drank it. I defy everybody to drink alcohol, defy you to drink alcohol, have it do for you what it did for me, and then stop. You just ain't going to do it. It just worked that well. And unfortunately, the sad thing about my life is that alcohol doesn't work anymore. The real sad thing is it stopped working about 5 years before I realized it stopped working. And I hurt a lot of people. And I suppose if it continued to work, if it was still working for me, I'd still be drinking it, but it doesn't work for me anymore. So I put the plug in the jug and I stopped drinking and solved the problem, right? Because now I'm an alcoholic and I'm not using the medicine that took away the alcoholism. So now I'm an alcoholic, living sober, and I'm chock full of alcoholism. And now I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm full of dis-ease and discomfort no matter what. And now I'm working on all those other medications that I use. Anything. Sex or romance. I need a girl. I need a guy. I need a car. I need a job. I need money. All the things they tell you in the world that everybody else is seduced by that you know is going to make you feel okay if you only had this, you only have that. And the problem is you get it and you feel good for a few nanoseconds and the next thing you know you had a meeting sucking your thumb and complaining about this and complaining about that and worrying about this and worry about that and... You know, and your life's a mess, and it's all because of this, that, and the other thing. All the stuff you were wishing and hoping for, you got it, and now it's driving you nuts. You know, and you spend your whole life thinking about these things that you acquired, and they acquired you. And you start remembering all of a sudden, yeah, I remember when I was real happy when I had nothing. And now I got everything, and I feel like crap. And what's going on? It can't be alcohol, though, because I haven't had any alcohol in 18 months, and it's not. It's something called alcoholism. And so like Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and... Like Bill D, I love when Bill D says, he was looking at Bill Wilson, he says, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. You know, they had a release, such a happiness, something going on in their lives that I knew there was more. I knew it was more than just mere sobriety. And there's some people that come in here and all they want is mere sobriety. You know, alcohol, I was talking today, you know, AA celebrates mere sobriety. Now the truth of the matter is we all understand there for many years, you know, after watching the crew and everybody that's coming in here and what's going on, that there are people that are not only, and that's not putting people up on a pedestal or whatever it is, that's just a fact of life. There are people in here that come in here and I saw them, they seem to have something more. You know, there are people here that are, you know, thumb sucking crybabies, or people here that are, you know, how you doing? Hanging in there, you know, and you know, one day at a time. People in here that walk around with chips on their shoulders or, you know, upset or living lives of quiet desperation. And there are people here that seem to be experiencing what they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, experiencing much of heaven and being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which they had not even dreamed. And you see, you have that whole crew in here. And, you know, you're free and there are people here that they don't want what we have. You know, that what they want is they want mere physical sobriety. That's it. They don't want anything else. They don't, you know, stay out of my sex life, stay out of my religion, stay out of the money, stay out of everything. I'm going to do exactly what I did before. As a matter of fact, I want everything back that I had before, the same people, places, and things, and I'm just going to stay sober. And AA celebrates that. It celebrates that. As a matter of fact, if you're of that mind to a certain extent, it'll almost enable you, like a codependent, enable you to be that way. Because every birthday, you know, we celebrate. He's got 10 years, he's got 15 years, he's got 20 years. And we clap your hands, and you could be a serial killer. And on your 15th divorce, and your kids may hate you, and you may be living a life of quiet desperation, you may be sucking on the muzzle of a gun. You know, but the bottom line is, you know, you pick up that 10-year medallion anyway because you haven't been drinking, you know what I mean? You see, you must be doing great. And the truth of the matter is that the way we learn about the other things is through things like this, through testimony and step series and stuff like that, and reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's some people, like Bill D, like me, actually, who came in here and they watched the whole crowd and they watched everything and they were sober and they knew there was something more. I knew there was something more. I knew there was something I hadn't got. I knew there was something more than mere physical sobriety. You know, and even if there wasn't something more, I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. I was sick and tired of being anxious. I was sick and tired of being scared. I was sick and tired of worrying. I knew there were people in here that had other things, and so I hung around them. I was attracted to that kind of sobriety. You know, not everybody is attracted to that. You know, you can't put a gun to people's heads. You can't put a gun to people's heads and make them want to not drink, and you can't put a gun to their heads and make them want to stop thinking or want to stop living the life they're living. We're all going to do what we have to do until we're ready to do it. And it's like that story I told you about my first wife, one of those, you know, we have some spiritual axioms in here. One of them is whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, that's how we grow, by latching onto that spiritual axiom, oddly enough. You see, before we came in here, you know, our basic concept is whenever we're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. You know what I mean? And the way you solve that problem is you go to a bar and you get a drink and you sit down with Desiree and I talk to Desiree about you, what a jerk you are. And how my life is crazy because of you. And Desiree does what Alcoholics do. She says, you know, you're right. He is a jerk. Let me tell you about the jerk in my life. And then I say, you know, you're right. He's a jerk too. And we both tell each other that the guy's a jerk. And the problem is we don't even notice that we're not getting any better. We're just getting worse. And so we come in here and we say, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. And I say, you know, I hate that guy. I can't stand that guy. I don't like him. Who is that Russell? Who does he think he is? And I hate him, and I can't stand him. And I say, yeah, but there's that spiritual axiom. No matter how much I know that he's the problem, it says there's something wrong with me. Why does it bother me? So I do these steps. I write this down. I talk to other people. And all of a sudden, I see, and I get, and I understand, not trying to change him, why does that bother me? And I see that there's something in me that really needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. There's something in me that's off. And all of a sudden, I see it and it becomes real. And I can grab onto it. It's concrete and it makes sense. And all of a sudden I have an epiphany and I change. You know, and all of a sudden, to the extent I change and I see what the problem is, all of a sudden I'm listening to the guy, you know, he doesn't bother me anymore. And over a period of 30 years, if you get enough people to bother you, if you can get around enough people to bother you and have enough things happen to you that bothers you and you go through that process, you get to the point where nothing bothers you. And I'll tell you, when even bad stuff doesn't bother you, it's hard to have a bad day. You know? It's hard to get all bent out of shape. And so what you got to do is find as many things to bother you as possible. But of course, alcoholics don't want to do that. What alcoholics want to do is they want to live a life free of pain. They don't understand about step 7, that there's value in suffering. So what they do is they want to do everything they can to avoid the pain. So, well, if I tell the truth, it'll hurt me, so I'll just lie. Or I'll just take this drink, or I'll pop this drug, or I'll avoid that situation, or I'm supposed to go there, but I'll stay away, I'll hide in my room. I'll do whatever I can to avoid growing up. You know, one of the books they read in Alcoholics Anonymous the first 4 years was 1 Corinthians 13. And they said it was absolutely essential. And in 1 Corinthians 13, there's a great line. It says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. I put away childish toys. And a lot of people don't want to grow up. They want to stay in AA kindergarten. where it's nice and safe and warm, and they can use the meeting sort of like they use drinks at the bars, and they just go from bar to, you know, they come in here, you know, to a, you know, like a discussion meeting, and they whine and cry about, you know, the girl, the car, the money, the bar, whatever the heck they're going to whine and cry about, drink some coffee, get a pat on the back, hear somebody that says something to make them feel better, and they walk out the door and they feel a little bit better, and they think they're doing Alcoholics Anonymous until they decompensate again and go nuts and go to another meeting, and they just go from meeting to meeting, life to life, never realizing that they never get any better, but they're getting mere sobriety. But they're not getting to that next frontier, you know, of emotional sobriety, which Bill Wilson said had to do with unhealthy dependencies. And if you think it's difficult to tell an alcoholic you have an alcohol problem when they're obsessed with alcohol, you try to tell an alcoholic man or an alcoholic woman that they have a problem with sex or romance or things like that, and they got to lay off the guys or lay off the gals or, you know, get their head out of their ass and start thinking about things that are serious instead of that other stuff, when their whole life revolves around, you know, novellas and soap operas and dreams, fantasy dreams of the perfect romance. Or you try to tell some alcoholic addict that, you know, their God, that they have a God and there is a higher power, and it's called their corporation, their boss, or their wallet. You know, and they got to stop putting that, because that's the only thing that they really care about, and that they're going to get nothing with that deal when their whole life is about, I'd like to come, but I have to go to work, where money rules their lives. You just try, you think alcohol is, you think that's the old idea? That's the easiest thing to go. That goes like that. The hard thing to go is all that other stuff. And one of the reasons it's hard to go is because the world celebrates that stuff, because everybody else is caught in the same deal. How could that be bad? You know, I can understand how alcohol could be bad, but how can, you think, it's even hard to sell the alcohol, because you see people drinking all, you know, what does it say? Men and women drink, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. When they succumb to it, they see others drink with impunity. We see others playing with toys and cars and romance with impunity. The whole world seems to be, every movie we go to, it's all about the, I love this, they take these beautiful shots of these gorgeous people after they've been made up for hours, and they take 15, what do they call them, takes, and they produce these movies, and we watch them. And they have this happy ending where guy meets gal and they're happy forever. And we, you know what we think? We think that, this is what we think. You ready? We think that that is, listen, real life. We think the tabloids, where they're getting divorced and shooting each other and committing suicide, we think that's like TV. I mean, we think the reality is TV. We think the real life is Pretty Woman. The prostitute that's going out and everything like that, and she marries a millionaire and they live happily ever after. That's what we think real life is. You understand what I'm saying? And you want to know something? And that's the whole world. That's every billboard. That's every run into, and they're all watching the same stuff. And when you think about yourself and how you're doing, you know, you think about it, you think, well, look at Julia Roberts. You're not Julia Roberts. You look at, your breast size, whether you need Viagra, whatever the hell they're telling you need out there to be okay. You know, no wonder we're all screwed up in here. No wonder we either have delusions of grandeur or we don't even know what we're talking about. We're basket cases. You know, we see through a glass darkly. You know, we see our reflection through the reflection of what we think the world thinks is important, and what the world thinks is important is all this stuff that's going to kill us. That's just not me. You know, you look at step 7 in the 12 and 12. It says we don't want to deprecate material things, but never have we met a class of people that so abuse money, power, romance, prestige, and things like that. So, and then it says, if we don't get rid of these old ideas, we must, or it kills us. You know, the selfishness, we must, or it kills us. We got to get rid of these old ideas. If we don't, the result is what? Nil, zero, nothing, nada. And so, like my, you know, one of the things, you remember my ex-wife said to me, I think I told this group about it, I'm sure I did. You know, she said to me one day, beautiful gal, nice gal, she said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I was as sober then as I am right now. She says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. The thing that was the most important thing in my life, my wife, my house, my child, everything was right up there on the line. And she said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I had all sorts of PhDs and degrees and all this stuff. I was a legend in my own mind. And I got in my car and I drove 5 blocks and I stopped at a light and I said, what the hell did she mean by that? And I was baffled by that thing. And of course, I came home drunk that night and that was the end of my marriage. And I'm going to tell you something. Anybody who hears the words, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you, and doesn't understand that because it confuses them, is going to have problems down the road no matter who they are. I don't care if they're Britney Spears. I don't care if they're talented, whatever it is. If you don't understand this is going to kill you, what the hell does it mean by that? It's going to somehow get you in the end. And then I ultimately realized that one of the problems that goes along with alcoholism, and it has nothing to do with whether you're drunk, is that whenever an alcoholic, because we're so defiant and we're so self-centered and our thinking is so mixed up, even though we think our thinking is the only normal way of thinking because it's the only way we've ever thought, so it feels comfortable to us. You know, it feels good to us because that's the way we are. I said to my sponsor, I said, this is my personality. This is just the way I am. He says, well, the way you are is killing you. Your personality's killing you. You better get rid of it. I said, get rid of it? What am I going to do? I don't know how to be my brother. You know, I don't know how to be that guy. This is the way I am. Well, the way you are is killing you. And, of course, I think I'm wonderful. You know, I mean, I'm my greatest fan. You know? I'm always defending myself. I mean, I got reasons. You know, I'll give you all my reasons. And so I come into this deal, you know, and I don't want to change, but I do want to change. It's all confusing. I don't want to change that much, and I don't really think I have a problem. And this, the thinking, the way I think, which is a toxic way of thinking, seems reasonable, logical. You know, and the smarter I am, the worse it is. Because if you're real smart, you can really bullshit yourself real good into thinking that you're right and everybody else is wrong and go on for years, you know, seducing yourself. And you hardly even notice that everybody hates you and you don't have any decent relationships and you hate yourself. You hardly even notice it until you're 60 years old and your life is over and it's been a total waste, you know. And then you don't even know how to get out of it, because how do you stop thinking the way you think when the only brain you have is in your mind and you don't have like a spare? And so you come in here and they say you got to change. You don't even know how to do that because you're surrounded by other people that don't want to change. And they're saying the same things you are. Don't listen to that guy. He's crazy. Because they don't want to change either. And you know, what happens is, what do? It's just like with my wife. You know, it's just what I said. That's the other axiom. That's what happened when my wife said, you come drunk one time, I'm leaving you. I said, what the hell does she mean by that? And then you learn that if you're an alcoholic and you're defined in the extreme, you know, and you're willful, what that means is that whatever you hear or see or you're told anything that you don't like, it confuses you or it gets you angry. And if something confuses you or get you angry, you rip it up and throw it away or ignore it. And you're ready for this? Now let me just tell you this. This is just what I found out. If you're an alcoholic, alcoholics don't like to being talked down to. And what you have to understand is, one of the things that happens with alcoholics is they don't like to be talked down to. You understand that? And there's nothing that makes a feeling that'll get a person who has an inferiority complex and feels crappy about themselves more upset than if they're treated like a person who has an inferiority complex. You understand what I'm saying? And what you have to understand is, when you're dealing with an alcoholic, when you're talking to them, even if you love them and for their own good, because of what they see and the way they relate to the world, if you just tell them something, it might be the most wonderful thing in the world. The way they're dealing with it is, they think if you're talking to them, they believe you're talking down to them. And it has nothing to do with whether you're talking down to them or that. Not. It has to do with the relationship they have with themselves, how they feel about themselves. Since they don't feel inside as good as everybody else, and say they compare their insides with other people's outsides, and they know deep, no matter what kind of bravado they put on, I don't give a shit what they think about me, who the hell they think they are. You know, we know that the reason we say, I don't give a shit about what they think about me, I don't care what they think about me, is because all we do every day is think about what other people are thinking about us. Mm-hmm. And the reason we worry about what other people think about us is because we think so little about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so the bottom line is, if somebody comes into your house, even if they're your life, and they're even trying to help you, and they're trying to talk to you, and they're giving you the keys to life, you spit on them because you think they're talking down to you. And what happens is, wouldn't you figure it out that if you're crazy, and you're operating in such a way so that you're self-defeating and self-destructive, wouldn't you guess if you go to a place where there are people who may have their crap together, wouldn't you guess if you start listening to them and they're talking about stuff, would you guess that they would probably tell you stuff that differs with your opinion? You understand what I just said? Now, I understand if you go to the bar where they're all, you know, cheating on their wives or, you know, going through divorces, and they're all like you, the greatest guys in the world. Like, I thought the guys I drank were the greatest guys in the world because, you know, yeah, you know, my wife is a bitch and his wife is a bitch too, and I wasn't going to see, you know, they're all like you and they're all patting you on the back and they're all saying, you're right, you're right, you're right. I know we like things, we like guys like that, people that, let's say, agree with us. Now, wouldn't you guess if you if your life is in shambles and you want to know how to change it, wouldn't you guess that if you go to some place where there's health and there's people trying to help you, you might run into somebody that might tell you something, you ready for this, that you don't like? What do you think the chances of there are? What do you think the chances of you coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and running to an old-timer and asking them about anything, I don't know, my job, my girlfriend or something, and them saying, no, you're wrong? What do you think the chances of that are? Like 100%, 90%? Now, if you're an alcoholic and you don't like what they're saying to you, you know what you do with that? You rip it up and you throw it away. And you don't listen to it. And you go on to the next thing. And so you read this nice little big book, which has all sorts of stuff in it, right? And you get to the end of it, and they say, well, what are you doing? I'm working on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And somebody says, well, what's that? He says, acceptance is the answer to all my problems. Because that sounds pretty good, and it's kind of safe, and you kind of like it. It's kind of psychological and spiritual and everything like that. I'm spiritual. I'm not religious. And apparently that's what the big book is all about. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems. Of course, acceptance isn't the answer to all my problems. But after 15,000 divorces and all that sort of stuff, you realize that that's a nice little statement, but acceptance isn't the answer to all my problems, because sometimes courage is the answer. That's the second part of the, you know, the Serenity Prayer. And faith is always the answer. Because unless you have a degree of faith, and even a greater degree of faith, you don't have the courage and you don't have the acceptance. And you don't have anything else. You know, because you're not going to get through this on brain power. And it all has to do with the various conversations you have with other people and your willingness to understand and hear what's actually going on here and accept it. And the truth is, these conversations are going on in the book, and these statements are going on in the book, and what you're reading, and it's all there. The question is when are you going to actually internalize it and hear the conversation, you know, and bring it into your life? And, you know, I've been around long enough, so I've seen this thing come full circle. I mean, I've seen it in action in my own life. This isn't a theory with me. I've seen it happen. You know, there are a lot of people in here that know me, and I'm telling you, I'm not lying to you. I wish I had a dollar for everybody that comes up to me and says, I used to hate you, and now I love you. And that has nothing to do with me, and what they're really saying is, I heard you say something in a meeting, and I hated you for saying it. I hated you for years. And now all of a sudden, that thing I said is like the centerpiece of my life, of their lives, because they realize it is true. And now all of a sudden, they don't hate me anymore. It has nothing to do with me. It has to do with the fact that I said something that they didn't like because it meant they would have to give up this activity or this person or this deal, and they didn't want to do that. So what they did was they put me on the hate list, and then they don't have to listen to me. They don't have to do that. And after a lot of pain and a lot of slipping and a lot of sliding, all of a sudden, somehow, some way, they learned for themselves, not because I told them, this thing don't work. And I said, wait a second, that's what that guy said last, you know, that guy said that 5 years ago. And I wouldn't listen to him. So it's all about the conversations you're having with people and the conversations you're having with people and who you choose to converse with and on what level you choose to converse with them is the conversations that will continue to go on in your brain for the entire day. And they're either going to be healthy conversations that make you feel good and build you up, or they're going to be conversations about people that make you feel crappy about yourself and crappy about other people. And once you know, one of the things we're addicted to is crappy people and crappy conversations. It's one of the things we're addicted to. It's one of the things we don't want to give up. You know, we give up the booze, we just want to give up our own friends. We don't want to give up our old friends. Because they talk crappy like we talk crappy, and they think crappy like we think crappy. And they act crappy like we act crappy. And, you know, of course, we don't think it's crappy. We think it makes sense because it's the only normal life for us. And all of a sudden, we're coming in and they say, no, you got to give up this guy. You got to give up that guy. You got to give up this place. You got to give up that place. We balk at that. And some of us get through to the first year or second year of sobriety, and you give up that stuff. And then they tell you you have to give up stuff like resentments. Can you imagine giving up resentments? I mean, resentments, I mean, that's like mother's milk. But, you know, but the truth is, and I was talking about it today, you know, how many times before you came in here did you say, They don't know who the hell they're screwing with. I'm going to get that son of a bitch. That son of a bitch is going to be sorry. He'll be sorry he messed with me. He's going to get his ass. He'll see. He's fooling with the wrong. How many times did you say that or think that before he came in here? 10 billion times? Well, how many times do you hear that kind of crap around here? It's kind of interesting, isn't it? You may hear it from a guy who first comes in, but isn't, you know, within 3 or 4 months, you somehow first listen that you listen that resentment is the number one deal. It has nothing to do with alcohol. It's resentment. It's the way we think. And all of a sudden you start thinking that maybe it's correct, even though you feel you have a right to resent. You have a right to resent. And then you give it up, and within a year or 2 years, all of a sudden they never hear you talking like that. All of a sudden you never talk like that. And if somebody walks in the room and they start talking about that, you just know instantaneously in your gut that guy's going to drink. Because we can't think that way. And even if you start thinking that way, you know you're in trouble, and you go to your sponsor and you got to get rid of it, because all of a sudden, a standard way of thinking that we thought all our lives, and has nothing to do with drinking, it's just the way we think, that son of a bitch, who does he think he is? I'm going to get him, he'll get his, he doesn't know who he's screwing with. All of a sudden, that whole way of thinking gets shoved down the toilet. You know? And that's where the real alcoholism is. You know, a lot of us get rid of that stuff, some of those other ideas, but what we don't see is the 20 billion other ideas that are right behind that. And how do we learn about that? How do we get rid of that? And one of the ways we get rid of that thing is through conversations, through relationships with people and who we have a relationship with. I want to read a couple things to you, and then I'm going to touch upon the fifth step in that regard a little bit differently than... Listen, here's the deal. Now, I want you to think about this term. Here's the term. Relationship. Relationship with God. Okay? You all got that down? That's the clause. Relationship with God. I'm going to read this from various sections of the big book. This is chapter 6, right before we do step 5. We've just done step 4. This is chapter 6. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator. Remember what it says in the first part of the big book? Where it says, we've experienced much of heaven, we've been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, this is the great fact and nothing less. The certainty that God is living in our Creator is living into our hearts and doing for us, which is indeed miraculous. He is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves, which is what they say in the promises. That's what they say in the promises. He is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. He is changing us. All this knowledge that we get, all this new knowledge, all this new way of looking at things, all this changes that we can't do by ourselves, who's doing that? You know what the big book says? It says he's doing that. It says see to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. It says he will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. We know but a little. God will constantly disclose to you more and more. Job or no job, wife or no wife, you can stay sober and get this thing. It all depends on trusting God and cleaning house. It's all about a relationship with God. The whole thing works on and hinges upon that relationship with God. But we are addicted to the world. We just know, you know, God's nice, but we know that really all our problems would be solved if we won the lottery. We know if we just had millions of dollars, but you want to know something? You can look at people that have millions of dollars, that are movie stars and everything, that are addicted or have addictive personalities, and watch what happens to them. You can see people that are on top of the world and how they fall. You can see all that stuff, and you can see what's going on. You can see it in your own life. We are addicted and obsessed. Once we get rid of the booze, then we get to experience all the other stuff we're addicted to. The women get to experience their addiction to the men and to romance. The men get to experience their addiction to the women and the sex. You know, we all get to experience our addiction with credit cards and money and things. You know, and, you know, blouses and permanents and, you know, haircuts and all the vanity stuff. Vanity, it's all vanity. We all get to see our addictions to everything else that doesn't matter. And understand, and it's hard to give up because your whole life revolves around that, us. I mean, how many hours do you spend during the day saying, I got to get my hair done? Why? I know. Girls, I understand you're saying, this guy is crazy. Well, maybe I am, and maybe I'm not. Think of all the other things you'd be thinking of if you weren't thinking about your hair. It's amazing, isn't it? Or you weren't thinking about your weight. Or you weren't thinking about what you look like. Think of what your life would be like if that stuff didn't bother you. It'd be amazing, wouldn't it? I know it's heresy, right? Bloomingdale's wants to crucify me. For what? For what? Because that's the way they make money. That all has to do with money. All has to do with making money. You know, but of course, we don't see it because we are swimming in that stew. How do you get out of that? Your whole life. How do you get out of that when you're obsessed with that stuff? You know, and here, that's not what AA is about. That's not what God is about. That's not what our theology, that's not what health is about. It isn't about that stuff. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean, like I told the guy, some guy came up to me last night, I was speaking to Boca, he says, what does that mean? You know what kind of car do you drive? I said, I drive a nice car. He says, well, that good. Thank God I don't have to sell my Cadillac. I said, you don't have to get rid of your Cadillac. You just, it says, it's not money that's the problem, it's the love of money.
Mm.
It's the obsession with money. It's not getting your hair cut or, you know, losing weight, it's the problem, it's the obsession with that stuff. You know? I sort of like the idea they have the Viagra commercials so men can be obsessed as to whether or not they can get a hard on. I like that. You know why I like that? And judge themselves and their whole life and who they are and what they are by that stuff. You know what I mean? The reason I like that is because, and I looked on the bright side of it, because now men have some understanding or some sensitivities of what women have had to go through for the last 50 years, last hundreds of years, judging themselves by what they look like, you know, whether men like them or not. I mean, I can imagine that crap. You know what I mean? We don't even think about that because we've never had to worry about that. Or, you know, now we got to worry about that crap. We wonder why we're so screwed up. Having made a personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. You may think we're trying to get psychologically fit or get better or get more money. We're trying to get a new relationship with God. That's what this book is all about. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship. Upon simple and understandable terms, as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try, the book is all about, wherever you go, it talks about, but no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect. This is like a new guy. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. And I could read in this book about 1,000 times where they say in different places, different ways, it's all about your relationship with God. And you want to know, some people will say that newcomers will run away from that stuff. I spoke before a group last night. There must have been about 150 new young people, 20 in their 20s. And I talked about the relationship with God. I talked about this stuff. I never get a problem with those people. They love to hear that stuff. You know, they want answers. They want something to what grow. You know who you get problems with? People have 5, 10, 15 years. You know, who are into mere sobriety, and they're saying, I don't want to hear this stuff because that means I might have to change and even give up more and sacrifice more, and I'm not into that stuff. I got my sobriety, and I'm happy with it. Don't mess with me. You know what I mean? Don't mess with me. It's the guys, it's the teenagers that have the problem with this stuff. And so it's the conversations you have. What kind of conversations you're having with people and what people you're having conversations, what are the conversations about? That's what the fifth step is about. It's about a conversation, isn't it? It's about talking to somebody. And, you know, one of the things that I understand about the fifth step now in my life is we make it sound like it's a special thing, and it is a special thing. Because if you're like me and you understand a little bit about the disease and alcoholism and being self-deluded, you've never had a decent conversation, an honest conversation with a human being, or had an honest relationship with a human being that's therapeutic and lifts you up your entire life if you're an alcoholic. Because how could you? Because you're dishonest and you're a phony baloney anyway. You wouldn't even know how to relate honestly anyway. You know, I mean, I didn't even know who I was or what I was always trying to say or do the thing that would make you like me. Why did I, you know, that's why you question yourself. Why did I say that? What am I going to say? You know, that's why alkies who come out of treatment say, what do I say, you know, if they ask me whether I want to drink? Think about that. Intelligent alcoholics go to treatment. They're told if they have a drink, they're going to die. And they say this. This is what they say. Well, if somebody asks me whether I want to drink, I'm at a party. What do I say? No. But they don't understand. What do you mean, no? They don't understand that. Because behind the question is the insufficiency felt by the alcoholic, is the other addiction to people loving them and not being rejected and not wanting to be looked down on and wanting to belong and be part of the crowd. So what they're really saying when they say, what do I say, is they're saying, tell me something I could say to them where they'll still like me. and they'll still think I'm cool. And they won't laugh at me behind my back because I feel like such a worthless piece of crap. I don't want to do anything that people won't like me because all I do is think about myself and how people think about me. And if you can't give me a cover story so I can make them love me for saying no to a drink, I'm going to have to drink. I'm going to feel compelled to drink to blend in because I would rather drink and destroy my life and destroy myself because I'm not worth much anywhere. Anyway, then risk the fact that this puke doesn't like me. So that's what they're really trying to tell you, you see, alcoholics, you know? Just like when an alcoholic walks up to you and says something bad about somebody else behind their back, what they're really saying to you, you see, I'm just telling you this is alcohol code, is I'm a worthless piece of crap and I think terrible about myself, but so I have to talk badly about somebody behind their back because I can get you to agree and make me feel good about myself. You know, so when somebody talks to you bad about somebody behind their back, that's what they're saying because they don't know how to talk good about people because they feel crummy about themselves, so they got to talk bad about other people. You got to understand alky speak. You got to understand what's really going on inside of an alcoholic and what we think and what our conversations. So when you converse like that, along with 1,000 other things that alkies think and do normally, which is their normal life, talking about people behind their back and all this sort of stuff, which has nothing to do with drinking, it has to do with alcoholism and being self-centered in the extreme and stepping on the toes of others 1,000 different ways. When you understand that everything we do, think, and act sober is all about unhealthy alcoholism because of our insufficiencies and we're sick and we don't even see it because that's the way we are and all the alkies and the crazies we hang around with act the same way we do, so it seems sort of normal. When you understand that that's the deal, you understand that you couldn't have a decent therapeutic, decent conversation with anybody in the world. You don't have a shot because you wouldn't even know how to do it. So how are you going to do that deal? Who are you going to go to? And the people that you're going to have a decent conversation with, you're not going to like them anyway because they're going to say shit that's going to make you mad. They're going to say stuff to you that are going to make you mad. It's going to upset you. You understand? You with me? Yeah. Well, you'll either will be with me or it doesn't. You got to be there. You had to be there. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just had to be there, you know? You ever see that? You ever joke? You say, yeah, I had to be there. You know, sometimes you just have to experience this stuff. Hearing it isn't enough. You just have to go through the years and the months and the years to experience it, to grow up. And so what the fifth step really is, it is really the first time, and look at all the crap we got to go through, between the fourth step and the third step and everything like that, all the crap we got to do just to prepare so we can have, for the first time, an honest conversation about what's really going on with ourselves. That's all it is, an honest conversation. What the fifth step is a template for the way you should be talking to people and who you should be talking to your entire life. And for us, it's something special, you know, because God Almighty, we never talk about anybody, you know, but you want something, the longer you do this thing, and I've been doing it for a long time, the more, you know, the more transparent you become. Man, the things I used to say to people, the stuff I used to, you know, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I want you to love me, you know. I'm not a leader, I'm a follower, you know. You know, I drink beer in country and western bars and, you know, margaritas in Key West and Manhattans or martinis in New York. I never get them mixed up. You know, I never go into a country and western bar and say, give me a whiskey sour, you know. I mean, they're all drinking beer, so I'm drinking beer. You know, I'd have people hate me. You know, and I don't even know how to be myself. You know, I walk into the bar, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, whether I'll be accepted, whether they'll like me a lot, whether the group will take me in. You know, I have a couple of shots, and I feel like I own the group. It's the greatest stuff in the world. But how are we going to have a conversation? I'll tell you a little story, and I don't know whether I've told this story before, but it's just an example. It's not even a fifth step story. It's just a story, you know. But it touches upon. I want to tell it sort of fast, and I'm going to do damage to it. You know, I had a situation that was bothering me for 6 months. I was about 7 or 8 months sober, and there was some very serious problem I was having in my life, having to do with fear. You know, I don't know whether you've ever had a situation where you wake up in the morning, think about something, you go to sleep, think about something. Mm-hmm. I think in your dreams you think about something. You wake up the next day, you pick it up again, and then you go to sleep and you think about something. All through the day you think about something. It sort of like hangs over your life like an obsession. You're thinking about the same thing. And you know something terrible is going to happen to you, and it's going to be horrible. You don't know what it is, but you know it's going to be bad. and you can't figure out a way out of what to do about it, and you can't talk to anybody because nobody would understand. You know what I mean? Or you're embarrassed to talk to somebody. Your pride's keeping you away. And this was something that was hanging on, not for a week or for a month, but like for 6 months. And I had like 7 or 8 years or something like that. And it was terrible. And I knew it was happening. And you couldn't even tell if I was in an AA meeting because I knew how to do the AA. You know, I knew how to talk in AA. I mean, if you know how to talk in AA and how to do the deal, you know, you could be wanting to kill yourself and nobody would really know. You know, and you know, so I went to a retreat. And it was just, well, the wonderful thing about it is if you try to stay sober and you don't want to drink and you're dealing with that stuff, the pain will get so significant and so bad that it'll force you to do crap that you don't want to do. And so I went to this retreat, and there was this retreat master, his name was Al Grau, and he had a PhD, and he was a war hero, and he was a survival of Bataan, and he was a psychologist, he was the head of the Palm Beach Institute, he was a Jesuit priest. I mean, this guy was like Jesus on the planet. I mean, this guy was the bomb, you know what I mean? I said, and he was like 80 years old, and it was the last retreat he was doing, and I knew if anybody could help me, it could be this guy. I knew if anybody could help me, it could be this guy. And so I signed up, you know, to see the priest. You know, I'm not even Catholic, and I walked in there to see him, and I started telling him. I told him who I was, and I started telling him, you know, my story. He had to listen to me, you know, and he says to me this. He listens to me for maybe a minute about what my problem was. I said, I got to tell you this thing I've been waiting to tell you. I mean, it's like I got to take a shit. You know what I mean? And this is what he says to me. Now listen to me. He says this. He says, you ready for this? I mean, it's pouring out. 8 months I've been saving up. It's pouring out. And this is what he says to me. Now listen to me. He says this. He says, I'm the wrong guy. I'm the wrong guy. Now I'm a self-centered, self-willed, crazy alcoholic. I've been saving up this entire retreat to tell this. He says, I don't want to hear this. I'm the wrong guy. And of course I say, no, no, no. You got to listen to this. You are the guy. He says, no, no, I'm the wrong guy. I'm not the guy. I'm the wrong guy. And he says, no, 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 you gotta listen. So he, you know, he stopped fighting. You know, I mean, I guess he learned that lesson. I'd rather be white, right or happy. He'd rather be happy. I'm not going to argue with this guy. Go ahead. Talk. So I blurted it all out. I said it all out. And then I looked at him. I said, so what do you think? And this is what he said to me. He said, what do I think? I said, yeah, what do you think? He says, I'll tell you what I think. I think that you are full of shit. I'm not making this stuff up. You know, you can't make stories like this up. There's a Jesuit priest, you know. Now, I'm not Catholic, and I don't know what goes on in confession, but I've seen the movies. I don't think they say you're full of shit. I think they say do 15 Hail Marys and, you know, whatever they say. It's not that. You know, I'm about to report this guy to the... I am, you know how they say we get a new perspective through 1,000 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency? You know, I am like a deer caught in, I can't even explain to you, the blood drained out of my, I expected a lot of stuff, but I didn't expect, you're full of shit. And then he goes on for about 5 minutes to tell me in detail why I'm a selfish, self-centered, full of crap. You know, I mean, it wasn't enough to tell me I'm full of crap, he had to explain it to me in detail. And then after he's done explaining it to me, he did, you know, sort of an AA priestly thing. He said, however, I love you, son. Go with God. You know? Did that thing they do with the hands, you know, whatever it was. And I walked out of there. I was like in a daze. And I would bump into people, and I'd bump into somebody. You know, I said, you don't talk about people on their back? And I'd say, don't see the priest. He's crazy. And I walked into my room, and there was a little cot there, and I sat down on the bed. It was just all it was one of these retreat outs. It was a little run by the nuns. It was a little cot, had a little cross on the wall. That was it, you know. And I sit there, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking like we think, you know, even though I had 7 or 8 years, like an alcoholic thinks, I'm thinking about, you know, if he had a wife, I'd kill her, you know, if he had a dog, I'd shoot it, you know, reporting him to the Pope, you know, I mean, love and tolerance is our code, who does he think he is, what kind of wacko is this, I came there for help, and he's putting me down, he didn't have to hurt me, you're not supposed to do that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going crazy, and all of a sudden this thought went through my mind, and it went through like that, like zip, right through my mind. You know, and here's, you know that line, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you? Well, sometimes the thought that goes through your mind doesn't sound like that. It sounds like this. maybe he's right. And then, you know, the next thought, well, that's a dangerous thought. Maybe he's right. That comes from years of AA meetings. Years of having this crap pounded in you. Years of reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe he's right. You know what my next thought was? He is right. That's the truth. He's absolutely right. And something that had been bothering me for 8 months that I couldn't get rid of went away like that. Went away like that. Never to come back again. My whole life changed. How I look at people, how I act. Fear of people. Fear that I had with people, a particular fear, left forever. Now, let me ask you something. What would you give to have a conversation like that? What would you give to... You know, you go to meetings, you go all over the planet Earth, you go to psychiatrists, you do everything just to... Maybe this guy will have it, or that guy will have it. You know, maybe you experience one time. What would you give to have a conversation less than half an hour? What would you give to have a conversation that changed your life for the better forever? I have those conversations every day. I have them every single day. Used to be once every 5 years. Every single day of my life, I have those conversations. What are the conversations you're having in your life? Are they doing that for you? That's what the fifth step's all about. It's a different way of living your life. It's a different way of talking. It's a different way of relating. It has nothing to do with alcoholism. It's not the normal way you're talking and relating. It's a whole different deal. You know? It's a whole different deal. And it bleeds. It's not something different or strange. It bleeds into your entire life. Bleeds into your entire life. And it changes you. It allows God's Spirit to come in, the Holy Spirit to come in, and He allows Him to do for you what you can't do for yourself. And all of a sudden you're hanging around people that are incredible people, having conversations that are incredible conversations, and people are coming into your life and you're saying, where did this guy come from? I've been having this problem, and all of a sudden I'm talking to this guy and he's talking to me, and it's about that deal, and he says this and I say that, and all of a sudden that happens, and bam, I change. I say, man, you know, some guy in the street. How does this happen? Because I'm involved in the stream of this deal. I'm involved in relationship with Him. And He brings people in your life. God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. And this stuff that you think is impossible, what I'm saying is impossible, is my life. Is the miracle. Being rocketed in the fourth dimension. This is the real deal. And people are hanging around here just so they could just not drink. Which is nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? When they could have the banquet. When they can have that deal going on. And all you have to do is just work these things. You know, and have a desire to have this. And I can't, and you know, I'll tell you what I can't do. I can't give somebody the desire. All I can do is tell my story, give my testimony. And I can't give people the desire to have it. You know, some people are going to walk away from here and they'll be changed forever. Not because of me or I'm special. They'll just see something different. They'll look at AA different. They'll look at their life different. They'll say like that guy in the book, I knew there was something more, something I haven't gotten. And they'll put a little in and say, man, I wish I could have that deal. And they'll want it. And they'll change. They won't even know they're changed. And some people walk out of here and say, I don't need to hear that crap. I think that's a bunch of bullshit. You know what I mean? And those people will not have, the ones who think it's crap or bullshit don't have to worry about it because they'll never get it. So don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to let it bother you because you'll never have that deal. You know? But you want to know what's funny? Some of those people that think it's bullshit, they will get it. Mm. Some of the craziest people that walk out the room, they're the ones that come back 5 years later and say, you wanted something? I thought it was crazy, but, you know, I got it. You know, we just have to go through what we got to go through to get to the place where we got to get through. Get to. Before fifth steps and being transparent and being able to talk to people and have honest relationships and knowing who and what we are and what's really going on becomes a normal way of life. So you're no longer acting like somebody else in order to fit in. You're being yourself. And let me tell you something. God, nobody can do you better than you. You don't know how easy it is to do you. You don't have to do anybody else. you do you better than anybody. I used to have people hate me because of things I said and stuff I did, and I realized that they didn't know me. They thought I'd have to run up to them and say, you don't like me, but you don't understand, that's not me. I'm not like that. I'm like this. You know what I mean? Because I was acting like that because I thought that's what they wanted, and then I realized they didn't want that, and I had to say, I'm not that, I'm really this. They were hating me for what I wasn't, you know, and now I'm who I am, which is easy to do. I don't have to, you know, that's why I don't need notes to do these things. I'm just who I am. And you want to, some people don't like me, but at least they don't like me. They used to not like me, and they weren't even not liking me. We're just liking the person I was pretending to be. But here's the great thing. The people that like me and love me, they love me. They like me for who I am. And you know, when people like you for who you are and you do you, you know what happens? You start liking you too. Amen. What do you think about that? And you don't even have to remember shit. You just have to be who you are. Isn't that cool? You don't have to say, what do I have to say? What do I have to do? How do I have to dress? Or any of that stuff, you know? God bless you. Thank you.